Welcome everybody to the next episode of our Learning Insights spin-off series, TechCure, where we get perspectives on topics relevant to the tech job market for students and recent graduates. We are continuing our discussion on future skills and their universal application across many disciplines. Here to guide us is Wayne Powell, a development architect at SAP. Wayne, hello, sir. Would you like to take a moment to introduce yourself and share a little bit about your professional and academic background?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, David. It's a great honor to be here. Thanks for inviting me. Yeah, so I'm actually one of the team product owners or the development architects within the digital manufacturing side. And specifically, we work on edge manufacturing, which is kind of a newer area for SAP to work in. It's a little bit of the extension of the cloud. As for academics, I went to the University of Waterloo out in here in Canada. I had an engineering degree, and then I basically returned to one of the co-op jobs that I had. So internship co-op jobs, what we call in Canada. And that company got, through a lot of acquisitions, became SAP. Basically, that's a short way of saying it. So I did not really change my position very much over the last 20 years, but the surroundings sort of changed. And so it's definitely been an interesting ride. Did a lot of different stuff like mobile, Internet of Things, and now we're on sort of edge computing, which is, seems to be a very hot topic for SAP as well as the larger global software.
Very cool. So you're voluntold to join us at SAP.
So it was great. Funny story is when I very started at the first startup that I was like Wayne at Media Serve or something like that, and then that became like W.Pow or W.Pow at Sybase or whatever, and now SAP I'm IA26714. So you can kind of see the way the sizes of those companies kind of worked out.
All right. Hopefully this is your last stop and you stay with us for a while.
Definitely.
All right. Let's go into our ASAP round questions, starting with academia. So which academic fields would you combine to further drive innovation? And I think that the source of this question is coming from the fact that there's many academic fields of study that touch on a larger topic, but only with a very narrow focus, maybe. Would you have any ideas on how to maybe unify or expand the field of view there?
Yeah, I think that's a great, interesting question. And I think we're in a world, at least knowledge-wise, there's a saying that says there's no really new sciences. We just sort of combine other sciences and they get kind of new fields. And actually, when I went to school, I was in a very unique engineering program called system design. And the idea is that there were jokes and saying, like, for example, with, civil engineers, they'll build the road, and mechanical engineers will build the tires on the car, and maybe electrical people will, computer engineering will build like the electronics, and the system design people will tell you what to paint it. That was the joke going around, but really we were looking at the holistic type of systems, and it ended up the chairman of our engineering department system design ended up going on building up something called knowledge integration, which was even more multidisciplinary. Initially was his focus was just in engineering, but through the whole university. And I really do see this as a future where we actually have to kind of step back and look at things more holistically. So design thinking, something that obviously SAP helped champion originally, helping, Hasso Plattner being very involved in the start of that. But when we look at where are we going right now, it is oftentimes the intersection of maybe technologies that some people might even call disjoint before. Mm-hmm. And that's where we're getting really, really a lot of traction. So one of the interesting podcasts out there, TED Talks, there's from Theo Epstein. And then he wrote a book. But the idea is that he was actually arguing that generalists actually may be the future. Because people who over-specialize early, they do have a lot of early success in their career, but oftentimes that success does not provide the longevity that some generalists did. And there's some of the greatest athletes actually end up having multiple sports before they finally settle down on their specific sports and do very well and become legendary status and GOAT, greatest of all time. And so I think that even more specifically, what technologies I would combine, I'd almost throw it back and say, what wouldn't I combine? Because even my university has turned into saying that we'll have a biomedical engineering degree or something like that. Where that junction point or that intersection of two technologies or two areas of sciences that were maybe not traditionally related or connected together are really providing kind of focus. So in my line of work right now, SAP obviously through the last couple of years has made a huge movement to the cloud, but edge computing is one thing that we did. So in my role right now, I definitely do bring certain things like from the Internet of Things kind of background as well as mobile, and you kind of like join that with the cloud and then you've got this edge type of thing. And so I think that if you were to really press me and say different lines, I would say that you could probably come up with some new combinations. Like, for example, some large language models we have. So I did a little bit of, we called it machine intelligence when I was going to school. Our professor did not believe in artificial part, so he renamed it machine intelligence. That was about 20 years ago. But that concept there, like, maybe we do need some people who understand the algorithms and stuff like that, but maybe we need a philosophy major to understand how, you know, what is our understanding? What does it mean? So one of the greatest books I did when I was doing a lot of quality assurance testing was a philosophy book about understanding what do you know? Do you know what you know? And it really helped us a little bit design some of our testing plans, because we could come from a philosophical point of view and say, are we certain about this? Are we not certain about this? So it is a very interesting question, because I think that if you stay within the original lanes or boundaries, David, that you had before, mm-hmm. it kind of really limits you, right? It's only till when you have this junction point of collaboration, much like, you know, you hear all these stories about Steve Jobs having one washroom in the Pixar, like, you know, like type of thing with this collaboration. I really believe that's the future.
All right. So thanks for that insight, Wayne. Something you've mentioned a couple times already is edge computing. Can you give a brief definition of that?
Yeah. So definitely, I mean, there's a lot of these long history, like how I started computing with mainframes and client server and stuff like that. But the idea is, though, for the last couple of years, what we've really done is we've kind of gone to cloud computing, sort of elastic kind of computing. I mean, Amazon has really kind of been the poster child for this. The idea is that, you know, you don't need to go to, say, some computer store like Best Buy and buy more memory. If you're in the cloud, you can just expand that. That's the elasticity that's in the cloud, right? You can ask for more compute. You can ask for more memory. You can ask for more pretty much anything right now. And you can also onboard different pieces of software and stuff like that. So it makes it really easy to scale up and adjust for companies, right? However, that has a dependency, strong dependability on things like availability and speed. And so what we're realizing is that, yes, when we moved on what was previously called, David, on-premise, right? So mm-hmm. you kind of like manage your own IT and then you've gone to the cloud. There are a lot of different reasons to go to the cloud, but there are also some of those reasons that our customers, especially in manufacturing and stuff like that, say, hey, hold the boat, because there are some things that we were a little more comfortable with on-premise. Like, for example, if the hard line or the connectivity of the cloud goes down, or we have a little more ability to manage or oversee those type of things where we've given up some of that management to the cloud, you know, they're kind of angsty. And so we either have to alleviate those fears, or we kind of have to kind of create up a solution that maybe had a hybrid of those two. And what we're seeing with that is that edge computing. So I forgot the exact quote, but like they're talking about sometimes you have so much data that you collect. So this is what we learned in the Internet of Things, right? So IoT kind of process, we're collecting so much data that you may not have enough network bandwidth or enough cloud space to store all that data to then process it for like a large learning model. So what happens is some very intelligent people can say, hey, maybe we can have this hybrid type of model where we have an edge part of the cloud, and potentially they use words like even like fog and stuff like that, where we can have some compute that's local and then that's connected to the cloud in one way. And then we can have the best of both worlds. And so, I mean, obviously there's very technical definitions for edge, but that's probably one model you could use in your head, is that there's a little bit or a large portion that's in the cloud. Mm-hmm. Like think of Amazon and all the hyperscalers and stuff like that. But you might have a portion that you want to have locally or not in the cloud for various reasons.
Okay. Makes sense. Thanks for that. Jumping to the next question, was there something within pop culture that sparked your interest and sent you down this technology rabbit hole?
Interesting question, because I, you know, people, it's kind of cliche, but I always wanted to be an engineer ever since I was little. So it's not going to see in the recording, but in the background, you see I have lots of Lego. I've always been a person who loves building things. I actually got my engineering degree. And although I went into software, I dabbled in different things like biomedical engineering and so on and so forth. But I always wanted to build something. And so it wasn't really pop culture so much as the toys and things I was playing with. I just loved building things and then taking apart and then rebuilding them. And so that is really what brought me down to engineering route. Mm-hmm. And then I tried a bunch of different things within engineering, including medical devices, like physical biomedical engineering. And what landed me back into software was that software has this amazing component that pretty much anybody is accessible. You can be in your basement, you can just learn a language and you kind of put that together. But the amazing part of also software, it can be built and teared down and replaced and then rebuilt very quickly you can compile a bunch of code instantaneously. And so we've even dabbled in things like 3D printing in some of our roles here. But the idea is that nothing outbeats the speed at which software can be built. And so that's probably what created my sort of addiction to be trying to be in these leading edge parts of the software development world.
Okay, very cool. Oftentimes on these podcasts, when we talk about these sort of future human-oriented skills, generalist type of skills, we almost exclusively have somebody on that has like a background or a focus in coaching, human psychology, that sort of thing. It's very interesting to get somebody whose primary focus is technology and you're a classically trained engineer to talk about these sorts of things, because working with other people is a critical part, I think, of almost any job, no matter how technical it gets. So I'm kind of excited to get your perspective on the following questions. The first one, starting with the general idea of future skills, human skills, soft skills. Would you say that they are universal across all jobs, no matter what you're doing? And have you experienced a difference over the past few years in terms of their value for your current role?
It's a great question. I think that I don't know if I'd say difference, but the world has sort of evolved and it's not even an evolution to changing something. I think the world has just sort of sped up. So even when I was much earlier in my career, you know, I started working professionally in the late 90s and stuff like that. We had like the boom bust echo of the dot-com kind of era. And then we had sort of, although the internet was created, it just really had that, its type of boom. We used to call this the idea of an internet year, right? Internet decade, sorry, right? So that was maybe 3 years, whereas a real decade would be 10 years, right? And even now that we've seen, it's even moved even faster than that. So definitely, I remember talking and thinking about your soft skill question. I think that one thing, there's a term, it's called hyperlearning, but I think that that's one thing that we knew even back then, but it's more critical now, is that the ability to learn how to learn or know how to pick up something type of quickly, right? And that skill is something that previously was a nice to have, but it's now almost a prerequisite for any type of job. So I give you a very concrete example. We do use a lot of frameworks and software. We don't write everything from scratch. It's not all from first principles because we need sort of that speed. But these frameworks, they sort of change all the time. And so previously, you know, you had all these jokes about COBOL programmers coming back, you know, 20 years later being rehired out of retirement because they knew that syntax. That's probably, I would say, an edge case. It's not really the most common thing, is that, you know, aside from maybe Java being very stable, a lot of times we're using, if we may be using even the same Java syntax or something like that, but we would change the framework and things like that. So we're always constantly learning things. And so it's not always that you knew, David, what that the way to solve a particular problem now that we have, but the idea is that you have to be able to have the tools to be able to find a way to find that. So that learning how to learn, or the hyper learning, is a soft skill that I'd said that was advantageous before, but absolutely critical now. And it is across every role.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I noted that you very aptly applied that skill of learning quickly to a technical issue. For example, learning changes to Java or a certain framework.
Yeah.
So I want to press you a little bit, Wayne. So let's talk about interpersonal sort of team between managers, between teams, between colleagues. What quality or skills would you say are you leveraging the most when dealing with a hostile colleague or somebody who vehemently disagrees in the direction that you want to move? And the converse to that, what skills are you leveraging if you're working with somebody that you get along with? Is there any crossover there, or is this two totally different parts of your personal, interpersonal skill sets that you need to leverage?
Interesting question. So I'm going to try to answer it in the best way that I can. I think I kind of come up from two different points. The first one is that I think one of that learning how to learn, or inspiring the ability to be like a lifelong learner, is that kind of curiosity, right? That ability to kind of learn, be interested. And that's probably the biggest motivation about things that you don't know, right? That curiosity. And I've really found that dealing with, if not necessarily a hostile colleague, a difficult one, or people that you don't necessarily naturally maybe collaborate well with, I think that curiosity, if you can extend that into sort of a personal frame, learning about other people, meeting them halfway. Mm-hmm. Like I have lots of stories, even my personal background aside from work, that there are probably some really good friends that I had that when the first time we met, we didn't actually get along, right? The idea there was that over time that we got to spend more time together and understand where the other people's points of views and stuff, that we ended up being found in more stuff in common than we had that was maybe disjunct or whatever. And we ended up being lifelong friends. And I think that dealing with other people, especially on a project that you don't necessarily get to choose, right? Maybe you get to choose your friends. You don't always get to choose the people you work on your project, right? And I think that having that curiosity of working with people, of understanding people and trying to meet them halfway, I think that you will often be rewarded if you sort of take that first step. Now, I do say that that works also, you know, obviously with people that you work well with, but maybe this is a hot take on that, but I did want to add that working with difficult people, I do think there's a tendency, at least from my point of view, sometimes to try to change and try to like make it kind of work. And I think that what I've probably learned after the fourth decade of working is that something I really appreciate being here at SAP is that I can be my authentic self. And there's things that I'm willing to compromise on, and there's probably things I'm not willing to compromise on. And so this is probably the hot take part of it, David. But the idea is that I think that sometimes, not necessarily the kind of standing your ground, but the understanding of having to meet in the middle, but you can still be individuals, mm-hmm. is a great type of thing, right? To be able to continue to be your authentic self. So we have the concept here in behavioral science of like, you know, code switching, right? So for example, I'm a Canadian born Chinese person, right? So there's different sides of me, right? And we would talk about code switching where like, you know, amongst my maybe Cantonese or Chinese speaking friends, I'm one way and then I switch into another more Canadian I think that the more authentic that you can be, the more facets of yourself you can bring in. And so both meeting people halfway, but also trying to be authentic to you. I think that if you can learn to be comfortable, and this is not always easy, but comfortable in your own skin, you bring more of you to the conversation and more of you to the team. And the more authentic you believe, I believe that there's more facets that can be uncovered. And that actually ends up being a win-win, both for people that you like and you don't like. But I really encourage people that to try to figure out a way to be your authentic self, because over time I've learned, and this was not something that I knew when I was my younger self, like it was that the closer you get to sort of this authentic you, the more of you can bring, that is a very powerful thing.
All right. I think that's excellent advice. And it will ultimately enhance your performance across all facets of life, not just professionally. You'll be firing on all cylinders, so to speak, if you're not operating with the impression or the feeling that you need to hold a certain part of your personality back. That just gets exhausting after a while, and you can't really be all in whatever you're working on. So very, very solid advice. Thanks for that. So let's throw you into a scenario here. A little unrealistic, but still fun to think about. So let's say you are forced to press the reset button on your career, and you erase all of your professional skill sets except for two. You will now end up at a random job somewhere in North America. No idea what that job will be. Which two skill sets will you take with you and why?
So I'm actually very prepared to answer this question. And I'll tell you why, because not right now, but previously in our career, we used to hire a lot of specifically interns. We call them co-op students, but we'd have these students that come up and they're in their university education and they're taking multiple co-op terms to try to figure out both gain work experience. That's definitely one point, but the other one's oftentimes they use it in different industries so that they can have a little bit of a taste of a little bit of different type of roles and jobs and decide maybe where they want to do on. We would call it the 40-year work term, right? As opposed to your 4-month work term, right? And I would get a lot of times talk to them and I would explain to them and they would very pointedly ask me, like, so Wayne, what do you want? Because I'm sort of a new, I'm not even graduated yet. What do I bring to the particular team? We're selecting the best of the best, right? And it's funny that for them to ask that type of question. And I distinctly remember over time, I've refined it, that I said to them, I really ask, because they might have, because we're, you know, we would be working on the job 10, 20 years or something. They've never, either never had any experience in the area or very small bits of experience, right? So this is what I said to them. I tried to calm them down and say, hey, there's really two things. I summed it up. It's two things I really look for on great candidates. And the first one would be the independent learner. So very similar to what I was talking about earlier, David. But the idea is that oftentimes I will give you a task and I may not even know the answer to, but you have to kind of find that out. And if I'm there spoon feeding you all those different answers, then I might as well have sort of learned it myself. And right. So we definitely talk to them about independent learning so that we can give you a task and maybe we don't give you all the information. Often we don't even have all the answers. How can you start filling those gaps? So that was number one. And the second one is being self-managed. The concept there is that, you know, it's not going to be like grade school where we give you homework every day. We're going to check it at the end of the day or pin a note to you to send your parents at home to read. Like the idea is that they have to be self-managed. The idea is that they have to organize their own work if they have oftentimes multiple tasks or projects on the go. And also, like, you know, if you don't have enough stuff to come talk to us. But the idea is that those two skills, it really didn't matter about the work experience, but if they were an independent learner and they were self-managed, I knew that they were going to be successful. They would be winners, no matter what other qualities and other things that they had, lack experience, more experience or stuff like that. Those two quality traits almost guaranteed successful co-op student.
Awesome. And I think that's excellent for new people to hear who are entering the workplace, because all too often I encounter people who are new and who are quite shy in terms of like taking initiative and just like throwing themselves at a task. They're oftentimes waiting for permission to do things, asking many very cautious questions, afraid to make mistakes. And I think it's important for new people to hear that they're free to just go after it and get after it and try to make it happen without needing to ask permission for every little step that they might want to take along the way.
If I could add one more thing to that, David, is that I actually have an acquaintance and he's actually working on a project where he's kind of doing boot camps or helping with boot camps, but for people who are actually changing industries. Mm-hmm. So what he was, I think he was in some manual labor profession before, and then he switched back into software much later in his life. And we were talking and he actually was talking about resumes. How do a person who's not necessarily in software industry, who's switching over into the software industry, what do they kind of put on their resume? What do they say in an interview that really help? And definitely those two things I definitely talked about earlier about being an independent learner and self-managed. But I think there are a lot of things that can be translated into a new role. Like definitely one of the ones that we talked about, Isaac and me, was that project management, for example, time management, right? So these oftentimes you're even in different type of roles and facets in life that, you know, you organize, you know, can you deliver on time? Can you understand how if a project takes a certain length, what has to be done by when, what things dependent on other things? So there's definitely a lot of skills that are translatable. So when you say the reset button, you know, it's that Ulysses poem, but like the idea that Lord Alfred Tennyson's poems, Ulysses, right? The idea is that you are a composite of everything that you've met, right? And I think that people should not underestimate the things that they kind of bring with the previous work experience, maybe not be directly related, but it's often quite a few transferable things.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And speaking of bringing previous work experience into a new job or a new career direction, is there ever a situation, maybe you could answer personally, maybe you can answer on behalf of your colleague who went from a manual labor job into a technology job, is there any situation where they had to sort of erase everything, or not necessarily everything, maybe they had to unlearn a particular amount of types of skills or way of operating? Do you have any examples of things that need to be unlearned, perhaps, in the context of a career switch?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, you know. In design thinking, we have the concept here of a sort of be in love with your problem, but not necessarily in love with your solution, right? So I would say that those, some of those challenges, sometimes we get attached to different things. So the example I was thinking about here, David, would be, as I mentioned earlier, although I haven't really applied, like HR applied to different jobs, I've had different jobs because we have the different acquisitions, right? And along with those acquisitions, different companies have different tools and different infrastructure, right? So like the email client that I used at Sybase was different from the one for SAP and all these other things. But what that kind of told me, at least because I had to go through all those acquisitions in those different companies where the sort of background or the environment type of change, I quickly learned to separate like the ability to do a task or how to do a task from the tooling or the way they approach, mm-hmm. right? Because different companies would have like a particular approach. And so I've seen this quite a bit of times, right? So we may develop very core, you know, if you went to back to university software design, like they're very core principles or design patterns. We might use that design pattern again and again, but the way that we implement it might be different. So the source control or the thing that we put the software in, like in the 90s, is very different from the ones that we use right now. And the approach and the way the branching, and it's very technical, but the way that sort of they store the copy or the current version of particular softwares that we're building, it's very different from where we did. But the principles of, you know, the good hygiene of, you know, well documenting your code, you know, approaching it logically, all that stuff. If not immutable, it's very consistent. Mm-hmm. But if you get to a point where you can, hey, what am I separating between the things that are the principal things that will always stay the same, and the other parts is like the syntax or the kind of periphery that can kind of change, and loosely couple those things, it makes it less stressful. Because I think if you just look at it, oh my goodness, my whole world's changing, everything is changing the way I did it. If you just take a step back, really, it's only maybe 20-30% of that last mile type of thing. But the idea is that the principles have not changed. So I think that when people talk about these new challenges and unlearning a particular skill, really take a step back and understanding what part of this is actually change. Does the change actually go as deep as you think? Because sometimes it really isn't, because some of these principles have actually stayed along for quite a long time.
Okay. And I think that definitely applies to style of collaboration. So there are certain principles and values attached to the way one should communicate professionally and interpersonally, but the mode could be instant message via MS Teams, email, scheduling call, etc. That's going to change. And I'm sure it's going to continue to change going into the future. So just the personal question to you, which mode of collaboration do you feel is most effective for you personally in terms of leveraging your collaborative skills?
That's a very interesting question, because as we sort of moved, as I explained, the acquisition parts and the company is kind of growing inside. Right now, my role is incredibly global. Mm-hmm. So on a daily basis, I work with teams out of Bangalore in India, Shanghai in China, Waldorf in Germany, obviously, and some other people in Genoa, Italy, and different parts of the United States. So it's really all over the place. And previously, when we started working, at least when I started working, most of the teams were kind of local, although the teams themselves might interact with other teams, but you never really have a team that was spread out that way. And just by chance, I'd been working with SAP.io and our 1 billion lives initiative that we previously had at SAP. And actually, it happened to be, I was designing training for that to be sort of done collaborative ideation. And we had picked out a paper way of sort of doing that. And at that time, the pandemic hit, and actually literally I had 72 hours to transfer everything into a sort of a localized paper process. And I actually didn't sleep over 3 days, and we actually used Merle. So that was first time. So there was actually, we were actually investigating it heavily. And then one of the previous groups years, I think a team from Australia actually suggested, we were actually thinking about like shared Microsoft documents, Office and stuff like that. And we went with Merle. We ended up being one of the first teams in all of SAP to really pioneer that. It was right basically when the pandemic happened, and we rolled that out in a global ideation program for the 1BL, and it was a massive learning experience. But the idea is that we were able to have like a shared workspace, a shared post-it note type of thing, and it's been incredibly effective. I was actually really, really surprised. I mean, I've been a design thinker. I go to Costco to buy my post-it notes. Like that's how many I sort of use, right? Like the super bulk Wayne size of post-it notes. But the idea to be able to do that online, I think that you can express yourself and find ways of expressing yourself in different ways, but it's the one that's going to kind of work with your team. And if that is something that has to be sort of collaborative, with the technology is really pushing it where you can almost feel like you're in the same room. And that's pretty incredible. But I think that what we have to realize is that if you cannot be in the same room, you need to over communicate. Mm. Right. So things that, you know, you could do with a hand gesture and stuff like that. So we definitely think about like post-it note. We have a couple nine rules at Stanford D School, but, you know, headlining, you know, if you can keep post-it note, even if it's online, especially keep it short, you know, it doesn't have to be full sentence, communicate. But the idea is also you have to make sure you're even more clear when you are remote than you were when you're in a room, because the clarification process takes kind of longer and you kind of want to speed that up. So I think that there are a lot of different things we're learning, but the speed at which collaboration is coming from and the amazing part of being working with a colleague maybe halfway around the world that lived a different life, had a different work experience and can bring that to the table, something's pretty amazing. But yeah, definitely to answer your original question, I think this digital brainstorming type of thing is definitely something I really like. I really appreciate. It's not something that we could have done before, but there are definitely pivots that you have to do from a sort of in-person part.
Okay, for sure. And what would you say, so going into Mural, for example, and having a brainstorming session with several people, let's go into a scenario where you're in a sort of cross-disciplinary scenario. I don't know if you, as a developer architect, if you've worked with people, I don't know, let's say from marketing, for example, what would you say is the most important factors for like a successful cross-disciplinary collaboration? And what skills or attitudes are necessary for both sides to successfully bridge the gap in each other's knowledge and each other's understanding of the context of what's going on in order to come up with a successful result?
I think that if you're doing this for the first time, definitely having somebody who is a sort of a trained sort of facilitator will help a lot. Mm-hmm. And especially one that has experience with the online, because I think that especially I've done this because in design thinking, we actually, when we tried to do these brainstorming situations, David, we actually tried to bring people from, if we go to a customer site, we try to bring as many people from as many different departments at different levels. And that automatically kind of guarantees you're behind the sort of eight ball, David, because they'll be at different level. They probably haven't worked together. You know, they do not have any of that, forming, norming, performing type of group dynamics there, right? And so they're going to have, if not conflict, friction, right? And so going collaboration magnifies that. But I feel like as having done some in-person as well as on a lot of in-person as well as a lot of online collaborations, I think that great facilitators have probably at least two very good skills. Is the one, the first one is ensuring that everybody has a voice, whether that's spreading out time for every person to make sure that whether they take the time or not, but they have the ability to speak. And then the second part is creating, it's very related, but creating space, right? So the idea is that oftentimes there's people that have a very strong a vision for the way that things go. And as a facilitator, you need to enter that and say, hey, we need to make some space for some other people to create some ideas or to make changes to your idea, right? So the first one is definitely about different people communicate naturally in different mediums, but you're going in this medium, so you may have to give extra care or extra help to some other people who are not as used to or is not comfortable in that medium, and whether or not that's like specifically asking them a question or spreading out the time so and then sharing that it can be used, if not equally, equitably, as I would say that, David, right? But the second point is definitely that concept of space, right? Because it's very easy for a collaboration to quickly turn into somebody's presentation, and that's not what you want.
Okay. Yeah, that's really great insights. I think you're a textbook example of somebody who's sort of mastered the cross-disciplinary field of being a human in the professional workplace, right? So you have this extensive technological background, but can also work between people. There's oftentimes a stereotype in SAP, at least in Waldorf, that the developer is always just hiding in the basement and not really speaking or talking with the business side at all. But I think you're a great example of somebody who can bridge those gaps and bring everybody together towards a common goal. So that's really cool.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate that.
So as we come to a close, do you have any final words of wisdom for newcomers to SAP, newcomers to the professional realm and of any capacity, or maybe even job switchers, maybe sharing some lessons learned, maybe, or an insight from your colleague who switched from manual labor into a tech industry that we can close on?
I don't know if it's applicable to everybody, but I'm going to give a piece of advice that I wish I sort of knew sort of when I started, and it's very applicable to particular to me and to my personality and my sort of the ways I sort of tend to. I'm generally sort of a, not necessarily outgoing guy, but I like being friendly and like meeting people, and I like collaborating, right? Mm-hmm. I think when you're starting out more so, but even for me right now, David, it's going to sound like a very basic type of thing, but you know, whatever you believe, you know, we have two ears and one mouth, right? So we should probably listen twice as more as much as we talk. And I think that there's a tendency, at least for me, when I look back, is that I was worried about contributing, that I had to be heard to contribute. I had to say something to be on record, to put my 2 cents, well, we don't have pennies in Canada, so 5 cents, into a conversation to make sure I heard that proved that I existed. What I've learned as it took more years on the planet, you know, we go going around the sun and more times, I think that one of the things that you can actually, the gift that you can kind of give is kind of listening, You can listen to other people and understand their points. And then maybe you've listened in a way that somebody else hasn't listened. And then you can come in and really give maybe an insight to somebody else or have support a particular idea that's not necessarily given the exposure or being, I should say, lobbied for as much. Because I think that as much as speaking your opinion, sometimes listening and helping either fix a gap or bridge people together or support an idea that you think that is not necessarily getting the support, but is that in fact a great idea, I think that's something that you can almost help more by listening than by speaking. And I think that's not something I really understood when I was quite a bit younger. I think now learning back is that sometimes I will, you know, I've always been encouraged maybe to speak, and I feel like sometimes I speak too much, but I really try to spend my time actively listening. And then that's my gift to a particular round, and actively listening. And then that way, what I can do is I can help interpret that, and I can help give more of a holistic view. And I think a lot of people are willing to offer their voice, but I think it would be great. The world would be a different place if a lot of people were to be offering their ears.
Outstanding. Thank you, Wayne, for your wisdom, your advice, and your experiences.
Oh, thanks for the opportunity. It's just a great honor to be here, Dave.
Thanks, everybody, for listening. And yeah, I'll end it at that. Keep listening. Bye, everybody.